Welcome to Coach Aria's podcast, Coach to Lead.
Hi, everyone. It's really exciting to have you here today. Over to you, Ram.
Yeah, hi. Let me introduce Janet and Jennifer today. Janet has been in several of our previous colloquiums. Janet Harvey was the president of ICF for several years, and she was the chairman of the ICF Foundation. And she has her company called Invite Change, which is in coach training and coaching. It's one of the most reputed bunch of MCCs who come together. I have had the pleasure of attending a session with them way back several years ago in Portland, Oregon. What Janet brings to the table is a tremendous wealth of background, just not knowledge, but wisdom, experiential wisdom of what she has worked on. And one of the subjects that that she has been working for a long time and extraordinarily contributed is of what she calls a sovereignty. I'm not quite sure exactly what space she is going to address today, and it's good that people like Janet to leave them guessing at till the last minute what they're going to say. And Jennifer works with Janet. She is also part of Invite Change. I just learned that they are both now at the ICF Converge at Prague, and so they are taking time off and from US Seattle to Prague and Prague to India for a short period of time in the cyberspace. Janet and Jennifer, all yours. Over to you.
Thanks so much, Ram, and welcome to everybody, my goodness, from around the globe. Mm-hmm. Those of you that are up in the middle of the night or the wee hours of the morning, my goodness, what a blessing to have you here and to spend a bit of time together. This subject of coaching across boundaries, when Ram sent this to me a few months back, my first instinct was to think about internal boundaries. And I think the reason for me is that I've been a student of my own work now for more than a decade, asking the question, why does what we do as coaches work? And I will confess, I am a hungry learner, but I am not an academic. I might from time to time say, I read this in a Carl Jung book, or I read this from Joseph Campbell, or I read this from Alfred Adler, or some other favorite author that any of us have. But I mostly read academically to help to explain what I'm seeing experientially with clients, with client systems when we're working inside of an organization, and frankly within myself. And the one thing that I can say for myself with certainty is that excellence and quality and professionalism and ethics as a practitioner is an inside job. My ability to consistently demonstrate excellence in any of those categories is in direct proportion to the work I do on myself to be a clear vessel, something in another part of my spiritual work I refer to as being a hollow bone. How can I unhook myself from preferences and biases and habits and ways of being that I acquire over time, and then somehow get complacent and forget to see what's right in front of me? And it creeps in unconsciously as the way of operating, but it actually stops meeting what's right in front of me. And the only way I know that is through dissonance. And I'll say one more thing and then give Jenna a chance to check in as well. I appreciate, Ram, that you remember the work on sovereignty. And to live sovereign for me means to be self-ruling, my own internal king and queen. And to have that sense that in every single moment, I am the author of my own life and I am at choice. I don't always remember, but the choice is always there whether I remember it or not. And what am I choosing? I'm choosing how I am relating to a given situation or relationship that I find myself in. And circumstances are going to always be transforming and evolving. That's human nature, that's planet nature, that's galactic nature. We're all in an evolutionary journey. And the one thing that I know that's in my control is that I can keep waking up. I can keep waking up and asking the question, what's happening now? What choice do I have about how I relate to it? And as I make that choice, that I stay present to the unconditional self-love that allows me to fully experience everything that's around me. So that's a little teaser for where we're gonna go today. And Jen, why don't you check in?
So, well, I'm so thrilled to have spent the last 4 days with coaches from all over the world and to be able to step away and then see from all the places everybody is joining from. It's really exciting. I've always been a traveler, an outer traveler around the world. This has always been my heart's calling, is to bridge gaps and differences and remove borders. Then it became an internal journey and an exploration of, all right, this is really about how am I relating to the world, and I can be out globe trotting and I can be connecting with people all over if I haven't paused to come back in and check in with, am I fully showing up to the best of my ability as the whole me here? Am I relating to myself in a way that reflects what I'm here to do and who I'm here to touch? So this going out and then coming in and then going back out and coming back in, it's like breathing for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm still assimilating everything that just went in the last couple of days. And what's remarkable to me so far in all that I've been hearing from these coach presenters at Converge, there's been a theme of what is it to take ourselves to the next level of not only self-awareness, but what we can hold for the people that we work with, the organizations and the teams that we work with. And for me, it isn't about being effective to be effective out in the world. It's how can I be my best self and let the parts of me that I have not yet known emerge and show themselves to me while I am keep that curiosity going for others. It's like turn that curiosity in and see where is my next boundary to push to dissolve? Where is my next edge to squirm in and in discomfort and edginess? Just and what do I have to learn by simply showing up like that hollow bone? I was just telling Janet before we came, I didn't use the term hollow bone. I said, I'm empty. Fill me. Fill me. So thank you for spontaneously asking me to join you.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing, and here I am, and I'm blessed, and I thank you.
Yeah. So I'm going to build on a couple of themes that you were picking up from the Converge, because I can feel myself internally a little disturbed by the articulation of assumptions about where the state of coaching is today and the state of capacity of coaches to do good work in the world and how do you go from good to great. And it all has to do with what Jen and I are both speaking to, and Ram, really, even in your introduction for the two of us, that our ability to see ourselves clearly. I know for thousands of years, this has been true in all spiritual practices around the world. And to be humble in the face of something larger than ourselves, in whatever way one defines that, spirit, God, universe, cosmos, it doesn't matter. All languages have this notion of something larger than ourselves. And how does the ordinary human tap into the divine within, to the extraordinary? And we've often partitioned it out of the sight of ordinary everyday life, and even more so partitioned it out of professional life. And I've been working this year, so sovereignty is something that's come forward in the last 4 or 5 years, and I'm still deepening into that body of practice. But I started to look at the question of, where do I stop myself? Where am I unable to do what Jen was talking about? And I've hit what I've described as a plateau. Do I even understand what's happening for me in that sense of plateau? And what are the clues by which I recognize that I might be in one? And what might be the explanation for it so that I have some choice now to say, maybe it's appropriate to be in that plateau. Jen and I were talking just yesterday about sometimes when we're cooking on a new idea, or we can feel that a season is ending in our lives and we're getting ready for another season, and it's not quite ready to be out. It needs to kind of get stuck in our chests, right? It's out of our head and in our bodies, but not all the way in our heart or maybe totally into our gut yet. And it's an uncomfortable place to be because we know something is calling us, but it's foggy. Can't get to it. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's one of the clues of a possible plateau being in place. So I'm going to kind of have us explore three things: the clues that you might be in a plateau, which would suggest that there's some boundary that's ready to be crossed, but you're not conscious of it yet. What some of the mental blinders are, what do we talk ourselves into? Attachments, rationally, objectively, we think, well, but of course this is the right way to go. That's one of those when we think we have a right answer. Right. And then emotionally, what are the beliefs and core value system that are the motivation to all decisions that human beings make? Because we are social animals. We require connection and belonging. It's fundamental to the DNA of our form of being a mammal. And when we can catch a glimpse of those mental blinders and emotional barriers, then we have the power of choice again. Now, I'm going to go back to something I said a little bit ago. I'm not here as an expert. The things that I'm going to share with you and that Jen will amplify out of her own experience, and we might do a demo, we'll kind of see how our time goes. They're simply what I've been observing. So please take this opportunity to say to yourself, wow, when Janet said XYZ, that made me think about, oh, this is the place where I stop myself. This is what shows up for me. So inventory for yourself what some of the clues of your own plateaus might be and where you might have attachments or beliefs that are the very thing that are keeping you small and not confident to take the risk to push a boundary, whether it's an internal boundary, whether it's to work with a client that's not someone you've ever worked with before. I've had the privilege this year to engage with a leader from Egypt who's working in Saudi Arabia. And those of you on the call that are familiar, that actually sets up difference. A cultural difference is very difficult to transcend. And it's easy for us to say we're all one common humanity. Not so easy in day-to-day work to find the way to bring resonance rather than dissonance in those relationships. And introduce then, here I am as an American woman and obviously not oriented to either of those cultures. And it's been a great joy for us all to be humbled, to keep peeling off the layers of assumption and bias and preference to say, what's the truth of the situation, independent of all the stories we make up about it? And what is it that we really want? We can't ask the question, what do we want, if we're not actually connecting to who we are. Who we are is how we coach as practitioners. Who we are is how we lead as human beings, whether it's leading our own life or leading others in a team or in an organization. And I didn't make up that phrase, by the way. That comes from Edna Murdoch, who is the founder, co-founder of the Coaching Supervision Academy. But I love it. It's a really simple way to understand how we kind of get in trouble in coaching the minute we think we're an expert about anything. Anyway, I want to catch up this other piece here in chat before. Stay empty. Any reason is to fill in. Emptiness or mindlessness is far larger than mindfulness.
I love it too.
I love that.
I've always wondered about that word mindfulness because it really amplifies my need for my mind to be active in it. But what happens when we let it go?
Yeah. We get cut off here. Yeah. And when we let it go, we can be fully embodied. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So here's my cues that I might be in a plateau to see if any of you are experiencing this. This isn't unique to coaches. I actually think what I'm talking about is that in nature, let's use the metaphor of a tree for a moment. All of you have probably seen a cut down tree and you've looked at the rings of the tree, and we know we can count them to know about the age of the tree. But another piece that might be less familiar to you is that the distance between the rings on the trunk of the tree tell you a lot about the conditions that it's been experiencing in each of the years of its growth. And when the rings are really close together, that's a year when light and water were limited. Not enough light, not enough water to optimize the growth. And it also makes the tree susceptible to cracking. It also makes it susceptible when there is a lightning strike to cause that tree to burst, because it doesn't have enough girth. It doesn't have enough foundation. So, you know, as a metaphor for me, the light and water for the tree is learning and reflection for us. That as human beings, if we're unable to pause and examine our own experience from the place of unconditional curiosity, I'm not looking for an answer that I can say, oh, that's it, I've got it. Rather, we're looking for, what is the quality of experience? What was it motivating for me in the way I was relating with other people? What was happening for the person I was with or persons I was with? What do I see was happening over time? Where were there patterns of what was going on? And, you know, we're of course talking about the self-awareness process. If I'm full up to the brim with my expert self and trying to analyze it. So one of the clues that you might be in a plateau is that your mind becomes obsessive. We become obsessive trying to figure it out. What's the right answer? And we can't get there. We're like, oh, well, let me just change this. So obsessive reinvention is one of my personal favorites. When I've rewritten a curriculum for the 16th time, I have to just sit back and laugh at myself. It's like, seriously, it does not require this. And the two more that are in the head, one is fuzzy logic. When I think I've solved the problem and I wake up the next morning and realize I can't remember the logic I used to solve the problem, that's usually I'm too full up. I can't get past my bias. And the third is that I find myself, oh gosh, what's the best way to describe this? I find myself wondering, I'm modeling for you. I can't make a decision. people will ask her a decision. I'm not ready. I'll call you tomorrow. I'll do that next week. I'll do it next month. And a month goes by and I haven't done a thing. So those are three of the mind sources for me that tell me that I might be in a plateau. So how about for
and
you?
I was thinking if chat. I were going to add one for me, it's unplugging, mentally unplugging. Mm-hmm. The one that intrigues me here is, why must each of us have a brand or an image we project to the world? Mm. And what would it be like if we didn't have to have a brand or an image? Well,
spot on.
In fact, what if who we were being in the world at any given moment of time is our brand and we were the ones being fooled, right? It's like, so the goal is, how do we really let ourselves be ourselves? What does that even mean? And where do we get in our way mentally? Where do we get in our way emotionally? It's not safe. I can't be myself.
Yeah. So let's go there, because the heart would be the next place that I would look for clues, because you're bringing up this notion of comfort. So I want to come back to that. So in the heart, one of the clues for me is I start to doubt myself. Insecurity, uncertainty, a certain level of mental judgment is coming in. I'm comparing, I'm competing. I can find myself being a little annoyed. I might be a little prickly. I might be a little edgy with people. And one that I discovered in the last couple of years and surprised me, but it's when I get surprised that I'm sad, that I have an emotional response of sadness when I'm watching a television program or listening to a conversation among colleagues, and I can feel that emotion well up. It's another indicator that I might be at a plateau moment, and there's something that's asking to be examined. And when you talk about identity, to me, in my own life, it's something I've had to work with every single day. I'm different. I walk into the room and I'm different from everybody else because I have a birthmark on my face. And cultures that are oriented to the image of looking right and the the comfort place that we can go to not have to suffer or be at risk of loss. Those are the two kind of extremes. We try to put ourselves into safe places to be in a comfortable rhythm. But what it does is it chokes out our life force and we can't connect to essence, the essential qualities of the human condition and the opportunity to be in self-acceptance, full unconditional self-love, transcends identity every moment. There is nothing to prove to anyone. And to be that at home at ourselves is, I think, what all human beings are seeking. And to me, this is another, it's an outcome of living a sovereign life. When I consistently allow myself to be a choice of the relationship I have to the conditions of my life, I'm no longer at the whim of other people's opinions.
So many good things coming up here.
You know, we'll come back to the ways to get there. I promise. I'll give you some ideas.
Yeah. And that staying empty can be to remain curious. And how do you remain curious when you get triggered, when something within you mentally or emotionally kind of hijacks the overarching awareness that you have?
Yes.
What happens when your consciousness gets
hijacked? This is a really good word. And I like the point about congruence. I think that's spot on. So one of the things that I love about somatic coaching, as some of you have explored that arena, is that the body, in evolutionary terms, solved duality. The body knows unity. It gets our attention when we fall asleep, when we stop being purposeful and conscientious about our choices. It gets our attention by disrupting our natural rhythm. Usually you'll start to see it because you're not sleeping very well. Or you might find that you're not able to sustain the same level of energy. You quickly fatigue in whatever endeavor you find yourself in. But I think the most insidious are the self-sacrificing behaviors. Whether that's, I was addicted to working. I thought it was perfectly normal to sleep 4.5 hours a night, and I am a highly productive, capable person, and I thought it was normal the way I was operating until I found myself traveling 6 days a week in airplanes. And after 4.5 years of that, I didn't have much of an adrenal system. And it ended up requiring me to spend 1.5 years getting my physical well-being back. But more importantly was learning about there isn't a right wrong. There isn't a yes, no. There isn't a black and white. There is a range of experience. And I have a responsibility to my own body to pay attention to what's the rhythm that's right now. Mm-hmm. And that was something that happened to me in my early 40s. I'm now 60. So 20 years later, I realized I don't get another chance at this, right? There's only so many years left. Every single day, it's important for me to attend to that well-being. That if I cross that boundary of paying attention to what allows my best natural rhythm to be the way I'm operating, then I'm shortchanging me and therefore everyone around me. So that's the attachment of trying to find nirvana. Nirvana is what's right now. If we allow that to be the thing we breathe into, and ultimately, trust, the self-trust of the spontaneous moment. And even if that's take a nap right now, you know, to have that be okay. One of my very best friends from college did her dissertation on napping in the workplace. And it was probably 12 years early because it wasn't very well received when she issued it. However, I think some of you know, Facebook and Google both have napping rooms because they figured out that much like South America did, that when you take a siesta after lunch, your brain is far more capable of operating. We've allowed the body to catch up with itself and to restore the ability to maximize the access to the executive function. If you're busy digesting food, you don't have as much access to the other things because that's what the body's working on. So there's body and there's heart and there's mind. All of these are operating and we often don't pause to pay attention to them. But if we can become a bit more aware, we start to see some of the attachments and beliefs that are keeping us small.
You know, right as you're talking, it's cracking me up because the addiction to too much work, workaholism, that almost killed me back in my late 20s. And then I had to find another way, right? Another strategy. And it was going to the other direction, looking for that nirvana or that place of peace and pleasure and joy. And how was that actually the same thing operating, keeping me, from really delving in and looking and examining and questioning, you know, what am I trying to avoid here?
Yes.
That change.
Yes, 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 yes. Transcendental meditation is one of the very best meditative processes for those of you that want to explore what level of access do you have to your full being. And really, I think the hubris of youth is we think that we have unlimited access at any time that we want it. And we have a lot of natural resilience, but as we age, it's not so much that you don't have access to it, it's just that you've filled up your being with so much. You must be more consciously aware about what you're choosing. And, you know, in some ways, I was watching this video, some of you might have seen this, Oprah Winfrey was interviewing Thich Nhat Hanh. And she asks him at one point, how is it that in all the times that I have seen you, both one-on-one and in this kind of format and in large audiences, you are always glowing with a sense of peace? And he just smiled quietly and said, because with every breath, I breathe peace. When I have a situation that's hard, the minute my thought is it's hard, I breathe peace and it's no longer hard. And I thought, that's it, right? I mean, it's such a simple answer and it is profound because we're so conditioned to trying to figure out what's the right methodology, what's the right technique, what's the right theory, what's the right premise. And I think in my own work as a coach, my best moments with clients are often the ones that are silent, where we're in the presence of each other, committed to allowing something to emerge that has never been considered or spoken before, and is only possible because both of us have chosen to be in a co-creative field, surrendering the need to be an expert, surrendering the need to know anything, and to see, is there another possibility that wants to be experienced now? And then experimenting with it to see what its relevance might be. And I've had some executives who have had things emerge in sessions, 5, 6, 7, 8 ideas. And at the end of the session, they said, thank God I don't have to think about those 8 anymore because none of them are right. And now I know why. And if we were caught at the informational level of what we were examining, they wouldn't have found the place that deeply within knew what was appropriate and respectful and the highest contribution to whatever it is they were working on. Which takes us to another piece that I think maybe we're going to do a demo about, which is an awful lot of coaches do a mix in their work of mentoring and maybe a little bit of consulting and maybe some training mixed in with their coaching, which is absolutely fine as long as you and client are both very clear about what modality you're using when. But I will tell you that what I've been experimenting with a whole bunch more is letting go of content and context altogether and really challenging my client to let go of talking about the replay of the situation as if the details of the situation matter, because they don't. The only reason it's disrupting their sense of ease is because something's gotten triggered in their body, in their heart, in their mind that no longer is congruent back to the earlier comment. And that's worthy of some exploration. Let's understand what actually got stimulated within you. That if you began to appreciate the belief that was triggered, the preference, the bias, the habit, now you actually have an opportunity to say, aha, that's old. It no longer serves me. It did for a time, it developed something in me, and now I want something else. I'm clear I want a different way. and we begin that process of constructing a new way of relating to a given situation, person, place, or thing. So what does that bring up for you? Because I think this is a place you're stirring in.
I am stirring in it. It's interesting. And I'm looking at some of these comments and questions. There's just so much, there's so much wisdom here. There's something that caught my attention about the body naturally knows unity. Mm-hmm. And it can tell when the mind, body, soul is separated. There's something about the whole of us, our wholeness knows when there is something missing. And some part of us is always going to be able to know that. And so how do we access that? What it was also bringing up is me being busy, 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 so that I'm not creating enough of that. Let's see, I saw the word in here and I loved it, air, in my brain to just be quiet enough to allow it in. That's why I just love coaching so much. And there was a question to us that I thought was really engaging, but they're coming fast. Let's see here.
I got the one about culture impact on the question.
I love that.
I'm going to pick that up in just a second. So,
okay. Yes. Developing compassion and renouncing ego are prerequisites, that middle way. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much wisdom here. How do we bring, so what part of us is expressing when we're expressing this wisdom, you know? And how do we stay connected with it, I guess, is the, so when I think of myself, I feel in the flow when I'm coaching someone else. I'm really in the flow, their flow, our flow of what we're creating together in synergy and relationship. Where I get off is inviting or creating that flow within myself in that space of quieting down. I do my morning practice every day. I get out in nature. Nature knows balance, and it seems like there's always something from nature. But how is it instantaneously available to me right now? And that, when it comes to me in my own practice within my own life, that's where I get hooked.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easier to let go as a coach than it is as a client.
I think that's a physician heal thyself. And that's why I started looking at this question of plateaus. If I could begin to see the clues of where I'd stopped fully embracing what shows up, where meditation becomes a practice rather than an experience, mm-hmm. of my own moment of oneness. I agree.
Actually, some of the best meditations are not the silent ones. Yeah. They're the edgy ones that are just so frustrating, that conflict or contrast then puts our attention to what it is that's wanting a voice or an experience.
Right. And so if I'm sitting in meditation and I can't close the mind chatter, I can either be mad at myself because I can't close the mind chatter, or I can put my hand on the top of my head and say, I'm a pure soul, and let the mind chatter go to that. It's another form of meditation. I can get my body up and allow my body to fully engage in a yogic posture and let the breath take the mind chatter and say, it's just asking me to pay attention. Those of you that study inner voices, whether that's voice dialogue or transaction analysis, any of the theories about the selves within, they are speaking to us because they're attempting to get our attention. There's something that needs attention within us. So that's why I say, to me, crossing the boundaries is an inside job first. And even though we may show up and have effectiveness with our clients, at some point we're going to become bored or we're going to become complacent and go, oh, so what? What does that mean? Are you being in the world as fully as you can be as a role model for a client to be in the world as fully as they can be? To me, it's the activation and that reciprocal inspiration that is the beauty of our work together. And I stop being that high value and contribution to my clients if I'm not doing it with myself. right? That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so that means I have a responsibility to pay attention to the places where I get attached to a certain way of working, or I'm caught in a belief system that's having me circle my own self and say, am I good enough? It, like false evidence appearing real, fear is the thing we get enslaved to suffering under, whether it's fear of missing out or fear of not being important or fear of other people's opinions. The minute I catch myself in that self-judgmental language, I have a responsibility to step back from my clients and attend to me. It might mean I need to take a day off. I've lost track of how intensely I might have been doing something. But nobody can tell me that. I don't want that to happen because a client feels dissatisfied or they fire me. Okay, it happens. We all make mistakes. We're human beings. But I can minimize the number of those if I'm a little bit more attentive to when my own internal boundaries have gotten crossed. And that's why we wanted to bring this to share with you a little bit.
I'm kind of hanging out in my zone over here in chat because it's become a spiritual conversation, which is that overarching whole place of how do I take myself out of that wholeness, of that unity, of that resonance? Where do I trip myself up? How can we each really examine what's really going on here? And the question, which role does intuition play in coaching? It's like, what part of us are we leaving out? And what part of us have we not yet discovered that we could bring to the table as a coach?
You know that in the competency language, you see a lot of repetition of the notion of following the clients or inviting the clients or noticing the client's way of thinking, learning, being, acting, right? That language is all over the competencies. And again, physician, heal thyself. We don't pay attention to ourselves. We can get really comfortable. I think the answer to the question is, why don't we follow the practices that would help us the most? Because we get habituated. Now, those of you that study neuroscience, you know that this is what the brain likes to do. It's conserving energy. It's a good thing. Habits help us release energy to focus on other things until we become so unconscious to the habit that we don't see that something has shifted right before our very eyes. Now, back to that question about how does culture impact? Now, culture can mean lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different things, but let's talk about your personal culture. Your whatever your sense of place in the world, time in your life stage, and maybe even your evolutionary development, your sense of having fulfilled your personal mission, all of these are part of your personal sense of culture. And of course, you don't operate independent of the planet. So there's the culture of the place you physically are in. There's the culture of your lineage, of your family, of your spirituality, of your community. There is the culture of the language that you speak. There's the culture of the spiritual traditions you follow. All of these things are operating all the time. I mean, it's miraculous that human beings ever get out of bed every day and function, because there's so much that we're so autopilot managing. And yet silence helps us pause and say, okay, here's what my head wants to do. And I'm going to say, thank you. And I'm going to pause again. Here's what my heart wants to do. Thank you. I'm going to pause again. And I'm going to let my gut instinct tell me what it wants to do. And I might even scan my entire body and see if there's some way, my shoulders, my hands, my feet. Do I want to be in motion or do I want to be in stillness right now? Even the act of pausing and scanning and asking the question. This is exactly the same thing we do with a client. If we don't do that, we won't notice that we should do the practice until we hit the plateau, which is when we're really at the edge. That's when we're, I would say, a little bit in trouble, right? We're in dis-ease with ourselves, which means we're working way harder when we're with our clients. And we're maybe not in our wholeness with our clients, which means they're getting a role model. Are you hearing the parallel process, folks? They're getting a role model of somebody less than wholeness, which is what we're holding them in. Hmm. And now we have dissonance in the field.
Yeah, and it's occurring to me also how, you know, the first thought I had is what lens, what cultural lens is there that we're unaware of, or what filter in our auditory system, or what behavioral filters might be there that are invisible. Going in as an empty bone has been a real gift to me, where I'm seeing dissonance within myself right now in this conversation is how I can give that kind of space and not completely give it to myself. Yeah. And when I can't give it to myself, am I inviting someone to hold that space for me? Am I welcoming someone to help me take the filters off when I'm looking at myself?
Yeah. Which is the incredible value of every coach having a coach.
Can't imagine.
Right? So when we're always on output in service to another, and we've allowed ourselves to be seduced into feeling great about how useful we are to other people, and we've let our tank get empty and we don't pay attention to it, it will backfire. It will backfire. And ultimately, we'll say something we don't mean to. The self-sabotaging behavior start to surface. We're just like our clients. So if you find yourself in a place of all of the sudden giving a lot of tips and advice to your clients about well-being in any of the domains we've been talking about, be listening. That's probably for you too. We used to say, I've done a lot of work with Jungian psychologists in circles, in dialogue processes, and we used to joke a lot about how just because it's projection doesn't mean it isn't true. So if I'm pointing out and projecting at someone else, those three fingers are pointing back at me. I cannot see in another what isn't already inside of me. I just might not be able to hold it yet. But we as coach practitioners are absolutely in the catbird seat, meaning the perfect place and time and moment to notice it, because our attention and presencing in the moment with a client is precious. It's we've suspended the ordinariness of their lives for a moment to capture what really matters, what's very meaningful, what's moving in them energetically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And in the beauty of that exchange, we get to catch a glimpse of ourselves too. And that's why, to me, this study I'm in right now about plateaus is really a quality and an ethical maturity practice for me. And as a coach educator, how do I help coaches along the pathway pay a bit more attention to their professional presence? You know, just coaching clients isn't enough. Ram, you know, so magnificent that you run this conference every year and give people a month. It's a little bit in the Christian faith, there's the period of Lent when you give up something. What I like about what you're doing this month is you're getting something. You're, you know, refueling and reclaiming and regenerating ourselves. And this is important as part of our ability to stretch the range of what we can engage with. We must refill our tank and know how to do that when it's time to do it, and to pause working until we feel our sense of being filled up again.
It's like going back to the well and knowing when to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's occurring to me, there's a lot about empty, there's a lot about silence. And what do we even mean by that? What is silence? What is emptiness? And how important language is, and even that filter of language can be a barrier. I create a lot of silence for myself, and I have a great spiritual practice. When I start getting caught in words is when I activate some part of my brain that needs to perform or needs to fit into the world or make sense of things, and it's the very thing that can get in the way. And how am I interpreting that? And so really that deep curiosity, that place of silence for me is a place of deep curiosity, of deep openness. It's a humility of asking, what is it that I don't know?
Yeah.
What is it?
So I love that you've brought humility in. I think I was with 100 budding coaches from a company a couple of days ago, and I was telling them a story of how I learned about reflection, which for a long time I thought, well, of course everybody knows how to reflect, but I had to really think about when did I learn about reflection? And for me, it was quite young, and as an athlete, I learned about how to reflect on figure skating. So how do I get up enough speed? How do I move my body? How do I learn to imagine myself spinning up in the air? And how am I going to land this jump? And that's reflection, being able to put into our mind's eye an experience that hasn't yet happened or just happened and play it differently. Not unlike what we ask our clients to do. Well, when I first started as an external coach practitioner, I did it first inside of an organization and then I went out. I found myself with 39 clients. I do not recommend this. Do not do this in your practice. I had 39 clients and no time for reflection. And I had a place in my work when I realized I had no idea if I was doing anything that was useful. My clients were happy, but everything inside of me was felt brittle and dried up. I had no access to a sense of satisfaction or fulfillment. And I started to see, you know what? I can't ever measure my effectiveness as a coach by whether my clients are happy or not. It's irrelevant. Yes, I want them to be happy. Yes, I want them to make choices in their lives that move them forward, to change behavior, to take new actions, to bust through the goals they set for themselves. Of course, I want all of those things. I want clients to want, and I want them to have the confidence to go towards it. And I pulled back and I said, what is right size in my business? And I couldn't answer it from the business mind. Right. I couldn't do it by figuring out my spreadsheet. I had to step back and say, what's the rhythm of relating that keeps me fresh, that allows me to be bold and brave with my clients, to challenge them to think bigger because I've been challenging myself to think bigger, that I am the instrument of the work. And if I'm not attending to myself, I will mitigate or lessen in some way the possibility for my client. And when the minute I got that insight, I was like, oh, humbling. Oh, so humbling. And you know, the truth is today I don't ever take notes in coaching sessions. Once a coaching plan has been set, it's really the client's responsibility. And we set a protocol for them to bring it forward when they're ready to do some reflection and review and see how it's going. And my job is to be as fully present as I absolutely know in every cell of my being, to see and hear on their behalf who they are being that is relevant to what they want. That's my job description. And I cannot do that if I haven't learned what my own internal boundaries are and am conscientious about managing to them.
Yeah, it took me many years because I do, I'm kinesthetic. So taking a note of some key insight was really important until I realized the place that we're sharing, I can trust. If I'm really merged with my client and really, really connected beyond the words, it's the energy that we're sharing, it's the understanding we're sharing, and the curiosity of when you say that, what's your language? Let me learn from you. There is something experiential that happens for me. It's like I become one with them in that moment. That is more memorable than any kind of notes or any kind of goals.
And you know, Jen, that's a really big piece of being culturally aligned. You can work with anybody on the planet if you're humble enough to say, allow me to see the world through your experience.
I got to be a traveler from youth on. I got into age 15, into other cultural environments. And of course I tried to learn a little bit of the language, but mostly the communication was nonverbal. It was expressive. I even found later in life, as I was learning different languages, that they were almost barriers to the kind of experience that we were sharing. And even today, travelers that come with me will say, oh my gosh, you speak your own language. What is that? And it's that language is love. You know, that language is, it's not just connection. It's a deep wonderment. What is it that makes this person alive? What is it that makes them express their most core self? And so I realized that my travels as a youth and the fact that I couldn't keep up with all the languages from all the travels was that this has prepped me for being a coach, in a sense of being able to hold space and enliven the space that we share with my being. I think there were a few more comments about being, not doing the coaching.
And it's in that enlivenment that the invitation comes.
Yeah.
That the, we heard a presenter today say something that I'm still chewing on a little bit. I'm going to share it with you because I'm not sure how I feel about it exactly, other than it is disrupting me. And it was, how do you coach a narcissist? Somebody who thinks they know all of the answers. And what this presenter was modeling is that you say, yes, you do know all the answers. And so what answers will you bring forward for your team? In other words, to validate the way in which that person saw the world. And at its simplistic, I would say yes. And I also wonder, we know that that's in some ways a mental and emotional limitation. It's documented psychology and physiology. So I thought to myself, wow, do I ethically feel good about that? That's the disruption I'm sitting in. And I realized that I've worked with lots of people who presented, I can't diagnose someone as narcissistic and would not ever try to diagnose anyone with any particular mental condition. But we can experience people as closed off and adopting a stance, if you will, a mindset and an emotional presencing that is shielded in all kinds of different ways, which to me, some people would say is uncoachable. And I think the answer is, have we created enough safety? Mm-hmm. I find even with the most aggressive, assertive, what we might even call a little full of themselves, ego, arrogant people, they're seeking respect, they're seeking love, they're seeking harmony, they're seeking belonging, all human beings are. And when I've stayed still enough and I've stayed in my own heart, seeing, perceiving, accepting them as resourceful and capable and innately creative, they eventually run out of gas. And they'll just look at me and say, I haven't had anybody just sit and listen to me for a really long time. I said, well, it sounds like it's overdue.
One of the sessions I just came from today, she said, okay, think of the three things that you hope people will experience in your presence as a coach. Mm. And everybody was very quickly coming to their three favorite words. And then the next one was, what are three words that would have you really annoyed and frustrated that people might perceive you as? And it was like, oh, I don't even want to write it down. I don't want anybody to see it, you know. And in one way or another, we're identifying who we are
by those words.
By those words, in one way or the other. And how do we learn from the words that, or the titles or the labels or the, that we resist and the ones that we bring on it? What's it saying really? And I really liked that contrast of, okay, now just tell your neighbor what your words were. And they were the very thing that I have realized were this film, this filter that I was seeing through and realizing, you know, probably the most effective approach was to, what is it I would never want anybody to believe about me or think about me that truly isn't who I am? I'm attached. I'm so attached.
Exactly.
And then it's okay. And so, and that was what I was experiencing in the breakfast this morning too, that someone was behaving, and someone over here was noticing how they were behaving. So, oh, that's a kind of ugly American image or whatever. And it occurred to me, wow, I bet the person that's behaving that way would just hate hearing that. Mm-hmm. And that some part of them would really benefit from self-recognizing. I mean, we can't teach it, right? We can't say it. And if we are, what are we trying to project, right? So there was something about how do, someone here says something about emptiness. Are we no longer engaged in thinking? For me, it's yeah. It, when I disengage from thinking, then I actually get to have a full mind, body, spirit experience beyond the analytical. But the analytical piece is still present, but it doesn't need to have a voice.
Right. That's exactly
that
right.
That voice gets in the way.
Several comments here about what judgment does and the divisiveness of it. And I've been saying for a while that I think diversity and inclusion got it backwards. If we were focused on inclusion, we would value diversity, because it's really about accepting this melting pot that is the human condition. And even if someone is behaving in a way that disturbs us, and take a note from Margaret Wheatley here, that what disturbs us is what enlivens us. Mm-hmm. If we don't let something disturb us, we're dying. We're not growing. We're not learning. We're not stretching ourselves. We're staying put in a finite place. And the world is changing around us. It's always evolving. Nature is always moving. Then it's up to us as humans, as part of the ecosystem of planet Earth and this galaxy, to move with it. And that means staying awake to the things that are emerging, even if we find them uncomfortable. When wasn't it uncomfortable? Don't we come out of the womb crying and screaming for food? The first gulp of fresh air? And, you know, metaphorically, that's what's going on all the time. So we can talk about alignment. It's a question for every one of you to find your own answer to. So we can abstract the term to say, how do you soften your eyes when there are two dots on a page and have your eyes be able to see them come one directly above the other? Classic thing they do when you go to the ophthalmologist to tell whether or not you have cataracts. And they'll move it, and your response is to tell the doctor when the two dots are over each other in alignment. So in what we're talking about here, when is your heart filled with the wonderment Jen talked about, the Thich Nhat Hanh sense of peace, the innate harmony, the sense of being in union with all that is around you? Nothing would throw you off center. You're in equilibrium, even though from a physics point of view, we're always seeking it. We're never in equilibrium. We're always pursuing it. There is that sense of, I'm in center. I'm not in center. I'm in center. We can always come back to center. How does our mind begin to say, I accept that all that is right here is in perfect order? Our body already knows this. If we can quiet into stillness, we can touch it in the stillness of the body. This is why meditation and yogic practice and journaling and music that moves us. I actually was, some of you might know the work of Anugama. And he studied a gentleman by the name of Alfred Tinnatus, who wrote a book called The Conscious Ear. Before he wrote Shamanic Dream, which is the main piece, it's the name of one of the albums, he was spending some time with this doctor who's actually working with Down syndrome and autism children who have a very difficult time with a lot of stimulation. And he saw that when you use drumming and musical instruments that mimic the sound that they hear of the mother's heart in the womb, and is the sound of the earth, right? There's the steady breathe in, breathe out. That music that's set in that cadence immediately calms those children. Mm. here's an experiment I want to give you to play with. When you're on an airplane and there's a baby somewhere on the airplane, doesn't matter how close or far away they are from you. If you'll quiet into your heart, go into your own center and breathe in and breathe out your place of innate harmony, that child will quiet. Mm-hmm. Never takes me longer than about 5 or 6 seconds to do it.
Oh, brilliant.
Everything is energy. So to me, alignment first, again, to the theme of what we're talking about here, is the boundaries within. When I can return home to center and be in center, I can emanate that center out to everyone around me. That's what we do with a client. We exude that sense of inner peace, inner calm, whatever language works for you. And we envelop our client in that state of acceptance and deep trust and the ability to say, I see you and I value all of who you are, even when you can't yet. I'll hold the space until you will, and I will be in the space with you. That was something you were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. Right? It's not just that we hold, it's that we allow ourselves to be engaged with all of who that client is and allow them to know we accept all of who they are.
So how does that relate back to that lack of context and content when we're coaching?
Gets in the way. I know that might sound a little cheeky. I don't mean to laugh about such a serious subject, although maybe humor is the way for all of us to work with what I think the depth of what we're talking about entails. And Jen and I have done this a few times for students in the classroom, where we'll model a coaching session where the client cannot say anything that is informational or contextual, but simply to reply to the questions based on what they're experiencing and how that's building their own sense of new awareness about how they're relating to whatever it is they're working on, which they never tell me.
Do we have time?
I think we, what do you think? We've got time to do a demo. Don't you think, Robin?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Cool. All right. So Jen's going to be my client. I'm going to do the coaching. And I'd give you these two tips when you're watching. Choose to watch either one of us, or to simply sit back and let yourself maybe have the gestalt of the session itself. If you're watching Jen, see if you can pick up where she travels within herself to answer. And if you're watching me, see if you can pick up energetically what I'm allowing myself to receive from her that's stimulating what I'm asking. Okay, has everybody got that? All right, well, let's shift from all that brain talking we did, right? And just take a couple of breaths. I'm just feeling lots of gratitude, Jennifer. It's always a treat for me to have this quality of time with you. Yeah.
And again, we just happen to be in a fishbowl.
I know. Let's pull our shade down. Okay, here we go.
Thanks.
Just you and me.
I'm feeling that same, and oddly enough, it's in the same region as the issue I've been grappling with.
Your self-awareness of where something that's emergent for you is living. It's really wonderful to behold. What's the way for us to be with it here that's useful to you?
It's occurring to me right now that your invitation is allowing it to be, mm-hmm. and that might be an edge for me, is how I haven't been allowing for it to be where it is, when it is, how it is. It's just I'm not allowing fully. I'm allowing in part, but not fully what's happening.
What are the qualities you experience when you are allowing inner information to surface?
Freedom. Freedom, like that.
Your whole field changes when you say freedom. And we struck on a high value for you.
It's just like a child in a field running, and like there's no time to keep track of, and there's no place, and it's truth. It's truth.
All right, so we'll hold that image of the child running in our mind's eye together as one way to know we're making some progress here. And as you sense into what's useful, where do you want this exploration to go?
It's moving that child from being curled up in a ball, really, to a place of touching the grass and feeling the wind. And it doesn't even need to feel full freedom. It's like, I have a body that I can use. I've got a spirit that can fly. I want to shift from this. Here I am making it wrong again, you know, shift from this space of being in the chrysalis, I guess. I guess my fear is that has a caterpillar ever rotted in a chrysalis because it stayed there too long? Because it feels like that.
There's an interesting paradox here of in a chrysalis is the place of allowing time for growth to be happening with protection. And this other side that says I might die while I'm in the chrysalis.
Yeah. Like it's confined with no way out. I stepped into it and it, and so it, I'm dissolving. I'm feeling that dissolving process.
What are you attached to here?
Where's the door? Where's my out? Where's the escape hatch? It's like no matter how much I can envision the butterfly or the little girl running in the field, there is something really intense about the letting go this time that hasn't been there in other times that I've metamorphosized.
What's your relationship to intensity?
It's so interesting. Two parts of my brain operated at once. One said, I thrive in it. The other said, get me the hell out of here.
Another paradox, another tension of some kind. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's feeling like there's someone else in the chrysalis with me. That's mm-hmm. There's almost a sense of a part of me that is wanting life that I hadn't recognized before, and it doesn't feel quite safe yet.
What is it safe for in the chrysalis, where you are right now?
Well, doing nothing. You know, it's almost like there's a part of me that's copping out when I say that. And yet the chrysalis is meant so that there is no effort, that there's no, that there's a falling apart that's happening, but it's being held safely. Like I can't, I'm not an egg yolk that's going to splat all over the ground. I've contained in my, so there's a safety in, as long as I'm not out of this, I'm safe, but it's also feeling somewhat dangerous in it. I haven't gotten to really talk in metaphor like this much about it.
So check in with your mind's eye, that sense of freedom to explore this and open it up a little bigger for yourself. What's happening so far?
This is so strange, but I got the image of if what wants out fully is birthed or comes out to express, it's going to create a ripple that is going to cause intensity, but it's more about others.
What are you wanting to control?
Others' experiences of me. So interesting.
Whose job is that?
kind of for a second made me feel like a narcissist. Did I need to take that class? Just makes me almost nauseated.
How familiar is that feeling?
Not very. I usually like a thrill ride, you know. I notice people around me getting motion sickness with the moving sidewalk, staircases, trams, undergrounds, just all the things that we were doing. And I remembered being a boater and my sea legs, how fluid I was, and it was like being a dancer in a sense. And about the minute someone else tipped to almost fall overboard, I would have to adapt to help them, save them, you know. And so it's almost like I'm trying to control how people are thinking about me. And
who are you protecting when you do that?
You know, the little girl that was told, you're too much, tone it down, you're not enough, you got to do this. It's, you know, that same darn recurring, not right. Enough, too much.
And what's the truth of today?
Jennifer,
yeah. Of today.
It's like, I am too much, and I'm also not enough, and it's okay.
I heard an and instead of an or. Show up in your language there. So where are you with this exploration right now?
Well, it became more of a dance inside the chrysalis. Like there's a give and a take and a kind of push and a pull and a
less dual.
It's less dual and more dynamic for sure.
What's the question you want to be with as we bring this little bit to a close here? To take into the chrysalis with you.
It seems so obvious. How do I trust the process that the whole of me understands and knows and just dance with the part that's contrary?
Yes, that dance each time brought the smile to your face and the sparkle to your eyes. So that's a resource I'm hearing you claim here. As you continue to deepen into whatever the experience is. Dynamic, non-dual.
It's a dance.
What'd you learn here? Just to bring us to the final close here.
That fighting myself has been an ongoing pattern. And therefore I don't fight in the world. Because, you know, the whole of me knows there is no fight. But the part of me that feels unwhole isn't sure and would rather put up a good fight.
You sound ready to fight the world in a good
way. Well, let's call it, let's dance with the world.
Dance with the world.
I don't know if I'll ever be a fighter. Thank you. Thank you.
Are we complete?
Are we being recorded so that
ready?
I can go listen to this again?
You're
okay.
Ready. All right. All right. Shades up. We're ready.
Goodness. You.
All right.
She's
so
pulling my own magic on me. You know, isn't that how we do it?
That is how we do it. Yeah. All right, so questions and comments. You want to keep going on that just to give them a sense of what was your experience of it, working that way?
So how many of you out there know yourselves to be verbal processors? And so my whole learning through my coaching, like really in the last 20 years, has been an evolution of what's the story I'm telling and how does repeating the story over and over again about my circumstances or the big decision I have to make get in the way of listening to a deeper part of me that knows everything that I need to do and no one else can know. And she didn't try to interfere with being a smarty and using all her knowledge of me to influence me in any way. It was like,
it wouldn't work anyway.
It wouldn't. It wouldn't have worked anyway. Yeah. Yeah. And
I'm looking here to see. Oh, Chris Ballard. This is going on YouTube, gals.
Oh my God, if it's on YouTube, how can I ever forget it? Maybe this will move me out of my dilemma, right?
Yes, it's being enshrined for posterity.
There you go.
And I just want to leave you with a thought, and you said about a dance. What I heard, honestly, I did hear, the song that playing was What a Wonderful World, I See Stars.
Yes!
And, you know,
fabulous, Ron.
It truly was a reflection of, you know, what you're looking for and where it's going. It's such a beautiful thing that was coming out. Yeah, I mean, it was an excellent representation of what you said, not going into context and deep content, much more into the experiential, the sensations of just what was happening out there. I just want you to go back a little bit into the point of plateaus that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that I interpret it, perhaps I'm wrong, was with stuckness and edge and so on. But I'm just wondering, is there a way to look at those plateaus as resting points and re-energization points?
I think that is spot on. Mm-hmm. I think that is absolutely spot on. I'm not raising plateaus as a bad thing. I think they're normal. I think plateaus happen over and over and over again. But when I started looking at this whole subject material, I realized that the first time I understood what a plateau was the moment I was standing, I was living in San Francisco, I was standing on the deck of the second story of my house, looking out at my backyard, and I'd had kind of a weird day at the office. And all of a sudden, the thought popped into my head, you're gonna get fired. I thought, wow, now that's an interesting thing. And I just kind of let it bubble for a little while, and I started to replay conversations over the last couple of months, and I could feel internally my own sense of, I don't fit here anymore. It's run its course of 14 years. It was absolutely wonderful. I enjoyed every ounce of my experience. And I no longer fit in the norm. I didn't fit in the box of where the organization was going. And I really didn't fit in the box for me. I was ready to stretch my wings and go be an entrepreneur, which I've been ever since. And in that moment, I had no heartburn. I had no edginess. I had no doubt in myself. I didn't have any of the things that I have been associating with plateaus. But what I did have is the sadness that I had put myself in that box. I had done everything that was ever expected of me. I had the title, I had the experience, I had the bank account, I had the house, I had the friends, I had the blah, blah, blah. Keep filling in the material, external evidence. But I didn't have me. It was the beginning of a really deep spiritual practice and an utter transformation of my life. And it was because I could stand in that plateau and not be in the critique that I wasn't enough and that what other people thought mattered. And I actually walked into my boss's office the next day and I sat down in his chair and I said, have you got 5 minutes? And he said, sure. And I said, I think you're getting ready to fire me. And you know what? I'd fire me too. I think you're right. I'm finished here and it's been fabulous. What I would like to do though is negotiate that I bring a lot of what you've had me working on in the change efforts for the last 2 years to the organization as an independent contractor. I want a guarantee of a contract for 18 months and I want 6 months severance. And, you know, if we can come to terms on that, I'm very happy to have this be a resignation and not put you through that. And he just pushed his chair back and he smiled and he said, I think we can do that. And that's exactly what happened. So there's this notion that plateaus are normal in our lives and we can hold them as suffering or we can realize, oh, this is the next step in my evolutionary journey. And I'm aware enough now of my life is always going to have highs. Then I'm going to go back down into the valley of learning and back up into the mountain of insight. I'm going to go back into the valley of learning. Yes. Let them be big Mount Everest and let them be very low death valleys because I want the full experience of what life has to offer. And if I can stay awake, and that's what I'm really looking at, if I can stay awake to those moments when I've fallen asleep, and I'm now in autopilot, I'm in preference, I'm in habit, and I'm not allowing the full spontaneous experience of life, then I get to have the full experience of life.
That takes honesty, self-honesty, because you can be on a plateau, and it can be a resting place, and it can also be a prison, because we're hanging out there.
Yeah.
And if I can be honest that I'm perpetuating my own prison or struggle, that plateau could be endless.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's like you tipped, it's almost like I can see you just tipping off that edge and making a conscious, intentional nosedive to the next place, because you let yourself move in honesty across the
Jen, what I heard was that you use that plateau to actually to regain, in your words, the sovereignty, and that's what happened. And when you had the session, one thing that reminded me of was when you were mentoring me and others, and what you said, it's like coaching is like you are riding a horse, and you know the horse knows where to go. The mastery is really letting the horse go where it does. So in that sense, coming to you, Jennifer, you were the horse and you were not being ridden. So how did it feel like? What was your experience?
She was carrying me into her world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what was your experience of being free and moving?
This brings back even 20 years ago, an image that was in my mind about how I was on riding a horse along the beach without a saddle, without reins. And I felt like I was sliding off. And instead of holding on so tight, there was this, again, loose dance between the rider and the horse, where the horse knew where to go because nothing was getting in the way. There was no there was a weightlessness about the rider. Yeah, never even thought of that.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's gonna mean a whole different thing when you start riding me. Just teasing. Woohoo! But yeah, it's sort of like the freedom of it's greater to feel the lightness of someone with you as a partner. Going through it, then going through it alone and allowing that self-doubt to creep in, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, we could have been on that all the way out onto the ocean, right?
Truly, from being a horse, you could become a whale or whatever else. So we have a few minutes. Anything you want to close with?
That last comment, it's liberating to remind yourself that you are enough.
Yes. Absolutely, we are enough. And I think the call to action I want to leave with all of you is that you have everything in you already to be magnificent in your work. You have it already to be magnificent in your life. And that you have with that magnificence a responsibility to disrupt yourself and to see that as an opportunity to live into the fullness of the human condition. And what a privilege that is. You know, the universe is within each one of us, each one of you, and in each one of us, and receive the gift and dance with it.
I'll use your term.
Mm-hmm. Dance with it as fully as you possibly can.
And thank you for all of your comments and wisdom and contributions.
What a joy.
We got to dance with your energy mm-hmm. too.
Very wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for this wonderful dance, Janet. You're always as excellent as ever. And Jennifer for joining and then being that wonderful counterpoint, the horse, the whale, the butterfly. The beautiful, beautiful energy that came up. Nishita, would you like to close?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for allowing all of us to witness that. It was really beautiful. The laughter through the demonstration is something that really lightened my heart while I witnessed it. So thank you everyone for being here with us.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. You can listen and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. We launch new episodes weekly. To learn more about coaching, leadership, and self-development, visit us at coacharya.com. That's C-O-A-C-H-A-R-Y-A.com. See you next time.